from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 7th, 2019. Yes, the first Sunday of July. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, taking you from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So time to grab your Sunday paper, get your cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, I hope everyone out there had a great 4th of July holiday wrapping up this weekend. I know that Dave did finally was able to get some time off and enjoy it.
After a long day on Thursday, I was able to enjoy Friday and was out at the Indiana Dunes, spent time with Dad. So, yeah, it was a good day on Friday.
There's something about, you know, having those holidays kind of in the middle of the week in some respects. It can mess things up.
Well, I kept thinking Friday was Saturday.
And that creates a whole host of problems you, knowing what your Saturdays are like.
Work. I have to be at work. No, not yet.
But were you able to cook out anything? Or?
No, not yet. My plan is because they've been doing work around my
building. Right, you've got the construction
building,
around your place.
I haven't really been able to get out. But this is going to be the week now, because not only because the construction crews have moved elsewhere, but because we're just going to have some terrific summer weather this week.
Yeah, finally. I saw the forecast where it was, you know, I mean, the humidity that we've had yesterday was absolutely stunning. It was just... it was so refreshing when that kind of the cold front blew in, and just to get those humidities down and the nice breezes. I mean, this morning the humidity was very high, and now it's seemed to have kind of rolled back a little bit, and the breeze is wonderful downtown. I forgot to issue a formal invitation to come over for I did the ribs on the 4th of July. And I did.
So that was the aroma that I smelled.
Yeah, but I did something different, because there's like the rule of thumb is you're not supposed to put the sauce on the ribs until like 20 minutes until they're done, so you don't burn anything.
Is this the famous sauce from Murfreesboro, Illinois?
Correct. And what I did was I actually marinated the ribs in the 17th Street barbecue sauce overnight. And then had them indirect so that they weren't, you know, wouldn't burn, and just let them cook low and slow. And then, as it was time to finish, another dab of the 17th Street barbecue sauce, and it turned out pretty darn good.
Mouth-watering just to listen to you, yeah.
And had the famed bacon blue cheese coleslaw on the side.
Oh, I forgot about that, yes.
And... I made a double batch, and I always make sure everybody, you know, gets their plates first before I do. Chef's prerogative, I call it. And, well, there's also that thing, too, when you've been cooking it, you're not exactly right hungry, because you've been kind of smelling it and all of that. So, but by the time I got to the setup, there was like one scoop of the bacon blue cheese coleslaw that was left after a double batch. So
it shows how popular it is.
So, of course, what I do yesterday, I went and bought the fixings to make some more.
Any particular type of special slaw that you use for this?
No, you know, it's the bagged stuff.
Yeah.
And then it's got a little red wine vinegar, or some honey.
Oh, there you go.
Some honey, some mayonnaise, and... Even though I'd say it's blue cheese, which is perfect, you know, you buy the little thing of crumbled blue cheese, or gorgonzola works really good, too, I should tell you. That's outstanding. And then double up on the bacon.
You know, I just thought of something here. You could say you can substitute the blue cheese with gorgonzola. I'm wondering if feta cheese might work with this.
You know, I'm not a fan of
feta. You don't like the feta?
Well, I just think blue has a distinctive flavor.
It does.
To it.
Yeah.
And feta, feta has a flavor, but I wouldn't say as distinctive enough to kind of cut through the various elements of the mm-hmm. of the coleslaw
mm-hmm.
as we dissect our coleslaw here on a Sunday morning.
I'm taking notes here. Copious notes.
Well, yes. Actually,
that's what you're writing down.
Yes.
Well, this was a recipe from Bon Appetit magazine, and I always joke that the most number of comments I ever get about anything on this show is when I talk about the bacon blue cheese coleslaw, and can I please post the recipe again. So, belatedly, I will make sure that producer Casera posts the bacon blue cheese coleslaw recipe. I'm just telling you, it's killer stuff.
Yes, it is.
A lot of tourists in town, which, you know, for 4th of July seems a bit surprising, but then it dawned on me, I bet there's a lot of folks here for the men's Gold Cup soccer tournament tonight.
Yeah, over at Soldier Field.
Yeah. And in fact, I walked by a downtown hotel yesterday, and there were actually barricades in front of the hotel. And apparently that's where the Mexico's national team is staying.
Hmm.
So, but there was a big crowd waiting for them to arrive. So a lot of interest. I know they're going to pack the place.
Yeah, they probably will. And, you know, this morning, everybody's going to be kind of at the women's side of things with the World Cup.
This is a big soccer day. And, you know, I had read some stories about some complaints from the U.S. women's team, a couple of members, about having the men's national team also playing in a somewhat of a championship with the Gold Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, World Cup, a much bigger stage. But feeling that maybe that was taking some of the attention away from them. And part of me can understand that. But at the same time, this is a big day for soccer. And to me, it's about the sport.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's different times, obviously. I mean,
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock in the morning, and then, you know, later on tonight for the Gold Cup. Yeah, but, you know, I get it, too. I mean, and there's been a lot of talk, especially in soccer, and it's been brought up by a lot of the women on the team. About the pay gap,
yes,
between the two.
Not just soccer either.
No,
that's
no, no.
Yes,
yeah,
any numbers,
correct,
sports.
And you know, and just in general life as well. You know, sometimes you start to think, and I think a lot of some people get turned off just because of the fact that, you know, athletes actually have opinions on things, which I think is just ridiculous. Because the saying "stick to sports" just implies that you only know one thing.
Well, but that's like you hear that about actors and actresses
exactly.
Over in Hollywood.
Exactly. So, I mean, these women are working very hard, and they're representing their country just like the men are. So, I mean, I get it. I mean, I completely understand what's going on there.
But I do think in the larger sense, though, I mean, this is about the sport. And, you know, I played it in high school. And so, you know, I can actually explain what an offsides trap is,
mm-hmm.
which that to me is like the real keynote, if you can explain offsides in soccer. But I just think it's a good day for the sport.
Yeah, agreed. I completely agree with you. I mean, you know, and the women have been getting, you know, a lot of attention over there, which is some for good, some for not.
Yes.
Their play on the pitch is, you know, I mean, that's you can't really argue with how good they are.
No.
You know, there was that whole controversy with the hotel situation with the British team and the England team and the sipping of the tea after the celebration of the, you know, I get that. But it is a good day for the sport. I've actually only called one soccer game in my entire life, and I had about an hour and a half's notice. And I just kind of hearkened back to my hockey days and tried to incorporate some hockey terms in there.
Well, true. And, I mean, it, obviously it's a different pace of play.
Much different pace of play.
And it's more strategic.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the net is obviously a little larger.
Slightly.
Yeah. It's not. I learned very quickly it is not the crease. It's the box.
The box,
uh-huh.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And throw-ins and corner kicks. And, yeah, you know, I started to kind of pick it up as I was going along. I was never really around it as a kid. I mean, mm-hmm. I was playing baseball most of my childhood. And I was never really exposed to it all that much, but I can admit to being a bandwagon kind of a fan for the World Cup stuff, and you know, you learn it as you go.
There's something wrong with that.
Yeah, you learn it as you go.
And frankly, this is a sport, and I may have said it before, it's a sport I think benefits from the HDTV and the wider format, because it's in many respects it is like hockey. It's about not necessarily where the ball or puck is, it's where is it going to go.
Where's it going to go, and where's the other action taking place? Because there's a lot of, in hockey, a lot of things happen between the two blue lines, you know, and in soccer you see some battles for positioning near the net and everything like that too. So yeah, I think the wider picture certainly does help, and the clearer picture certainly helps as well.
Well, and also I mean, watching those wingers too is our high school went to the state tournament in our second year of the team, and it was we played the state tournament was down at Illinois State, and it was the first time we had played on artificial turf. But also, it was the first time, talk about a pitch, it was the first time we played on a pitched field. And I never realized how much of a pitch that is. And those poor wingers are trying to make plays, and they're, you know, basically running uphill. So it's not like just you're out there running, you know, for 90 minutes plus stoppage time. You're also running uphill for most of that time.
Just, you know, like walking to school, uphill both ways.
Exactly, yeah. So the wingers were a little winded, I will admit that. But, I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, as we'd say. But it's more kind of watching that strategy play. And you know, yes, occasionally there's going to be a blowout. But for the most part, it's, you know, it's very measured play that goes on.
Yeah, and the talent level is extreme. I mean, it's just what they do without using their hands just kind of amazes me to watch, just because, again, I'm kind of new to all of it. I'm trying to be more tolerant of other sports that I never really grew up watching, and kind of, you know, just kind of poo-pooed for a while. But you know, the talent level is crazy, because I'm watching these women and even in the men's games, you know, going up for headers, and they're colliding with each other. There's no padding.
No.
There's no helmets. It's kind of like Australian rules football, you know, meets soccer. But when they go up for those, try to get the header, and then the scissor kicks, it's just, I don't know how they do it. I just don't know how they do it.
Well, we played, I remember it was our first year when we played one team that will go nameless, and their trick was that, rather than necessarily go up to try to match the guy for the head ball for a header, they would actually stay on the ground and hold the opponent's shorts.
Oh, nice.
So that they would be jumping out of their shorts.
Okay. Well, that seems to be a little less than sportsmanlike.
Well, actually, it's part of the learning curve how you play the sport in some of these places.
Yeah, just kind of like what happens at the bottom of the football fumble pile.
Yeah, correct.
A lot of things going on down there that you don't really want to know about.
You really don't want to know. So I'm excited about that. Excited about the Cubs-White Sox series.
A huge crowd yesterday.
Yeah. And actually, they have been drawing really well this week.
They really have. I mean, it's they're an exciting team to watch. You know, for as much as what happened yesterday, going down 6-1, having your arguably your best pitcher all year kind of lose his release point in the fifth inning. They had the tying run on base at the end of the game.
Yes, you know? Yes. Don't think I wasn't noticing that.
Yeah, I mean, they usually find a way to try to get back into a game. And it always seems, at least recently, that the guy that you'd want up at the plate at that time is up at the plate at that time.
Right.
And they've played some amazingly crazy games. The extra inning game against the Tigers the other day with Moncada hitting the home run in the 10th inning that almost left the ballpark to right center. Right. And then Abreu winning it with the walk-off. And, you know, it's interesting to watch how these younger players are developing over the course of the last year and a half. And now Luis Robert is going to be going to AAA. He's just tore up a Double-A. And he and Nick Madrigal are going to be a part of the world, part of the American League team in the Futures game today.
Oh, very good. Yeah. No, because I was curious. I saw about the promotion at AAA.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, they're moving him right along here.
Yeah, I have a feeling, and I know a lot of Sox fans are saying, oh, could he be up in September? Could he be up in September? Yeah, I don't. Judging from the tone of voice that Rick Hahn was using yesterday, it almost seems as though they want him to stay at AAA for the remainder of this year, and really fight it out in spring training for a spot in 2020. That's just the impression I get.
Yeah, and I think that's smart.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. And who knows? You know, we get expanded rosters, don't
yeah,
we?
So. Yeah, and things can change. I mean, obviously, if he goes on a tear, and, you know, I think what they're trying to figure out, too, because when he first got the double A, he scuffled a little bit and then figured it out. It's a little bit of a different situation in AAA.
Yeah, it is.
Because you've got a lot of guys who are former major leaguers that are trying to get back to the big leagues. You've got some other guys that have been away from baseball and have come back and, again, trying to earn roster spots after playing in Japan or playing in the independent leagues or what have you. And it's just a little bit of a different philosophy in pitching in AAA as opposed to AA. And as Nick Madrigal was pointing out the other day on a conference call, he said the first thing he noticed about AA is the strike zone got a little smaller. And in AAA, it's going to get even smaller because, as Darren Jackson told me the other day, the umpires are better. Yep. As you go up the ranks, because they're at a point where now where they've advanced.
Exactly. They're part of the same process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to today's game as well.
Yeah.
It's just, and finally, you know, in this weather, too. It's all perfect.
Yeah,
you know?
It worked out well. And the fact that there's going to be some great weather around here for the All-Star break does not upset me one bit.
I'm sure.
Be taking a little time off here.
Get to enjoy some time.
Exactly.
Yes.
Maybe I'll actually get on the golf course one of these days.
Whoa.
Haven't done that yet this year, which is kind of making me a little angry.
Well, go for it, man.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Sounds good to me.
That's Andy Mazur. He's got all of our sports. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Producer Kisara is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And Engineer Bob is sifting through Thursday's leftovers. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break on this beautiful Sunday. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. I actually wanted to say that I'm not in the Allstate Skyline studio. Instead, that I am covering the Continental Army, which I'm told that General Washington has now seized the runways and a baggage claims counter at the Philadelphia International Airport. They've also got the Continental Army has also captured runways 27L and 27R, but there's fears that a British Airways Concorde may be flying overhead soon that could jeopardize our battle for independence. I'm just going to play this cut from President Trump's 4th of July speech. And in some respects, it speaks volumes.
The Continental Army suffered a bitter winter of Valley Forge, found glory across the waters of the Delaware, and seized victory from Cornwallis of Yorktown. Our army manned the airport. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rocket's red glare, it had nothing but victory. And when dawn came, their star-spangled banner waved defiant.
So, yes, we got the airports. Also, just if that wasn't bad enough, it's Fort McHenry, not Fort McKendry. And the Star Spangled Banner came from the War of 1812, not the Battle for Independence in 1776. Now, of course, he said, you know, the teleprompter failed because of the rain, and he first blamed it on that. But then when he was asked about it, he said, oh no, I knew that speech very, very well. That's the 4th of July from the President of the United States. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to your Sunday Spin. A little action on the text line after playing the president's speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial, a little portion there. And it was a beautiful speech. You are a disgrace to mock him. And it's like, I'm not mocking him. These are his words. He said, General Washington's Continental Army seized the airports. I wasn't mocking him. That's his words. You take it. I mean, there's your beautiful speech. Those are his words. He talked about the Continental Army at Fort McHenry. Fort McHenry, it wasn't the Continental Army. It was the Army of the United States. It was the War of 1812, not 1776. I'm not mocking him. These are his words. I'm a reporter. I deal with words. Words matter. That's our stock in trade. I'm just, those are his words. Speaking of words, on the Democratic campaign trail, many candidates spent the 4th of July in neighboring Iowa, obviously the First in the Nation caucuses home. Over there, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg was offered advice on how to deal with crime and racial issues, which have been an issue in South Bend.
And I have a solution for you, and I'd like you to make a comment on my proposal. Just tell the black people of South Bend to stop committing crime and doing drugs.
I think that racism is not going to help us get out of this.
No, just stop committing crimes. It has nothing to do with race.
The fact that a black person is four times as likely as a white person to be incarcerated for the exact same crime is evidence of systemic racism. It is evidence of systemic racism, and with all due respect, sir, racism makes it harder for good police officers to do their job, too. It is a smear on law enforcement.
Also, last week in a CNN interview, former Vice President Joe Biden said he wasn't prepared for the way that rival Kamala Harris went after him in that first debate on the issue of busing.
I was prepared for them to come after me, but I wasn't prepared for the person coming at me the way she came at. She knew Bo. She knows me. But here's the deal. What I do know, and it's the good and the bad news, the American people think they know me, and they know me. Since that occurred, I had the most sought-after endorsement for the mayor of Atlanta, a black woman who's a great leader, Mayor Bottoms, endorsement. I've had numerous members of the Black Caucus endorse me.
Now, since then, of course, we had the vice president yesterday actually apologizing for his references to noted segregationist senators in the past. It's taken a while for him to make that apology. At the same time, we have Kamala Harris saying that she wasn't really endorsing federally forced busing, even though that's the issue she supported when she went after Biden in their first debate. So you've got all kinds of things going on in the Democratic field. Well, let's bring things closer to home. And joining me now is Doris Martinez with the Onan Staffing. And it's a member of the Staffing Services Association of Illinois. And we've talked in this program for a while about on various sides of the issue of this what's called the Fair Work Week Ordinance, the staffing scheduling mandate ordinance for how it affects workers, how it affects employers. And it's truly, this is not an ordinance that's necessarily, I think you'd agree, is not a proposal that it's one size fits all.
You're right.
I mean, as far as concerns, employer concerns that you have, maybe you could explain where you're coming from on this.
So as a staffing company, our major concern is that with this ordinance, we will lose the flexibility that we offer to our client companies and our employees. It would take away that flexibility that now employees have to come into one of our companies. You know, we have staffing companies are a huge employer in Chicago and Chicagoland and surrounding suburbs. And just the fact that we would have to give advance notice to employees 72 to 2 weeks, and that employee would no longer be able to walk into one of our offices and be able to get work that very same day. So that would be taken away from people that really can't afford to lose that.
Is there more of like a transient nature in the people that work in staffing services that's part of the concern here?
Well, we have, you know, over the years, there's a lot of diversity. There's we have people that, you know, just want seasonal work. We have people that, because women, single mothers, that maybe are looking for extra money or can work only in the weekends. So it's all kinds of walks of life that come in through our offices to earn extra money, or people that just want a second job. So they can only, you know, work in the afternoon for a second shift or a third shift. So the reasons for people to walk in through our doors vary, but, you know, it's just the flexibility that they're able to do that. And with this ordinance, it would definitely take that away.
Well, let's talk about what, I mean, this is something that the Chicago Federation of Labor is very much in support of. Bob Ryder here, the president of the CFL, explaining his support for it. And, I mean, let's talk about what they're asking for, if you would.
So what they're saying is that so right now, say that a client, one of our clients, you know, they have a big order, one of the manufacturing clients that we have, and they say, okay, listen, tomorrow I need, and it could be, you know, as soon as the next day. So today they'll call in for an order. They'll say, we need your services. We need 10 additional people for tomorrow for whatever process, you know, what we need. So we would lose that, because now we would have to reach out to all of our existing employees and wait for them to get back to us and give them a schedule. But, you know, because it's the next day, I mean, the law says 72
hours. The proposal, that's what I was going to say. The proposal they're talking about, what are they asking for in that proposal?
So they're asking that we would have to notify them to 72 hours in advance, or 2 weeks. And then if we need to cancel, then we would have to pay them for the lost hours plus, what is that? So, but we already have that. We have a 4-hour minimum that we pay. If we cancel the employee for whatever reason, we have a 4-hour that we do pay out. So, but that's what the law is calling for. And it opposes what our companies stand for, which is flexibility. We wouldn't have the luxury to do that anymore.
We're speaking with Doris Martinez with Onan Staffing. We're talking about the proposed workplace scheduling ordinance that's a discussion going on in the Chicago City Council. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I'm speaking with Doris Martinez with Onan Staffing. That's a firm that's a member of the Staffing Services Association of Illinois. We're talking about the workplace scheduling ordinance that is under discussion in the City Council, something that Bob Ryder from the Chicago Federation of Labor said expects passage on later this month. I know in talking to him that there has been, and even in the past, there were discussions about various exemptions based on, you know, certain size companies, based on certain needs. I know Sam Toya from the Restaurant Association has talked about, you know, restaurant staffing and how the hospitality industry needs some kind of flexibility, because, you know, sometimes you get a lot of people, you get a surge of people coming into a hotel or a surge of people at a restaurant that isn't always as predictable. And I guess that's kind of the real ultimate issue here is, you know, flexibility versus, you know, wanting to have an established schedule. But not all jobs are scheduling, is what you said.
Right.
Can be scheduled. Have there been talks about trying to get, you know, staffing firms, those kinds of firms, exempted out of this ordinance, or some provision for how many employees, you know, the size limit on who's affected by this ordinance?
I believe right now they've actually started. Well, is anyone that has over 100 employees? So we would, you know, definitely our industry would be extremely affected by that because we are a large employer as an industry. We're a large employer here in Chicago. We have a huge presence. So it would, you know, it would definitely affect all of us.
But has, I mean, have there been discussions about exempting
I know
firms?
That we've actually met with the alderman, and we've had very good conversations with the sponsors and the Mayor Lightfoot's office. So, you know, we're hoping that we can find a compromise and that we, you know, they can consider it that we want to be exempted.
So you noted on the one hand that you do compensate if there's a cancellation, which is one of the conditions that's in this proposed ordinance. But, I mean, is there anything else that you can do from your employment as an employer here to try to provide some kind of predictability against flexibility?
I mean, we can. You know, we do have long-term clients, but at the same time, because of the supply and demand from a client standpoint, that, you know, they might, you know, again, it's just the fact that we would not be able to provide that employment, that the same day employment, the next day employment to anyone new, because we would have to definitely reach out to anyone that's already in our database, in our system. And sometimes, you know, it's hard. It's hard to do that.
And I mean, I would assume, too, that part of those employees, part of why they do this is because of that flexibility.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is definitely
They don't want to have a traditional 9-to-5 jobs that is scheduled.
Absolutely. We are not a traditional employer, and that is what makes us different, and this is why we're asking for the exemption.
So if you don't get this exemption and the ordinance goes into place as is, what does that do for the staffing industry?
It would be devastating for our industry, you know, and it would hurt the people that need it the most, you know, because of the, if we violate any of what they want to, by law, we could be sued, we could have hefty penalties, and, you know, so it would be devastating for us.
What, for example, your company, what are these, where do these employees work at?
I mean, seriously.
No, I mean, what is kind of the gamut? What's the range of?
We service our clients from array of, you know, industries. We're in manufacturing. We're in distribution. Right now, we're in logistics. You know, that's a big industry that's coming up because of all the distribution that's going on. So, you know, even bakeries, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think one of our members also has substitute teachers, you know, so.
And so, I mean, part of it is it's fill-in work. Part of it is supplemental work.
Yes, yes. You know, and that helps the economy grow. I mean, you think about clients that, you know, if you'd have to go out and hire 20 people for a week, it doesn't really make sense, right? So that's why the staffing industry is there, and it helps out that with that growth, and it provides, you know, additional money for people that need it.
So where do you see this thing going?
Well,
I mean, it's...
As I said, you know, we're really, really hoping. We're not the only, obviously, the only industry that's looking for a better path forward, you know, a resolution. And we hope that, you know, we would be considered to, because of the nature of our industry and the employment, you know, the size of the employer that we are, that... people consider that, and the people that have, that want to pass this, and that they realize that it's going to be hurting people. And I hope, because we all want to help, right? And if we want to maintain that opportunity for people, I mean, we're a gateway for someone to come and walk in the door. We provide training, you know, hands-on guidance on how to interview. Where else in a traditional employer, you're not going to be able to walk in the door, go through what's you know, what jobs you have open, and say, yeah, I'm interested. When can I start? And you say, today. And you say, really? Okay, I could start today. I could have money by the end of the week, and, you know, whatever. So it would be devastating for people, for us not to be exempted, and we have to abide by the new law, and it was, you know, it's just, it would be chaos, really.
As I mentioned earlier, there was provisions at work in the previous city council, negotiations going on there, that obviously the old city council came and went. There was no action on the ordinance. This is now the new city council, and as I said, CFL expects action on the ordinance this month. But, I mean, were there provisions in the previous talks that actually, you know, were more beneficial towards staffing or staffing agencies or the hospitality industry?
You know, I honestly don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. It's been a few years now that, you know, Chicago has the Day in Labor Act that just protects the employees, and you know, the fact that we have so many laws that just protect a person who is an employee, and you know, I've been in the industry for a very long time, and it's amazing that it's so rewarding for me to stay. I stay in it because we do provide employment opportunities for people that would be taken away. So hopefully, we'll see.
No, it sounds like, I mean, what you're saying sounds very much like what Sam Toya says from the Restaurant Association is, you know, these are in many respects gateway or entry level positions, and providing some experience that, you know, as far as like the restaurant industry, that you can be in the back of the house and you're going to gain so much experience, you'll be in the front of the house and you may end up running your own business.
And we've had that. We've had a lot of our clients, they hire a lot of our people, you know, they're employees, they're great employees, they become supervisors, and you're absolutely right. I have a prime example of somebody that was, you know, general labor, and now it's a BP, you know, BP of operations, which is amazing. That's amazing for us to say that.
Sure. It's a great goal story to be able to demonstrate.
Absolutely. You know, didn't have the means of going to college or anything like that, but like you said, hands-on experience. I mean, that's valuable.
And in this economy, you know, there's a lot of transients going on,
yes.
And there needs to be some kind of flexibility, obviously, but also some dependability, too.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
That's Doris Martinez with Onan Staffing, part of a member of the Staffing Services Association of Illinois, and that's their views on the Fair Work Week Ordinance, as it's being called, which is being considered by the Chicago City Council, expectation that they'll act on that later this month. Doris, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River and beautiful Lake Michigan on this beautiful Sunday. And joining me here in the Skyline Studio is Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Rick. Good morning, everybody, and go USA women's soccer. Woohoo!
Why did I have any doubt that you would have a soccer, you'd be sporting a soccer jersey today?
Of course.
I fully expect you'd be out on the pitch somewhere.
No, I'll be sitting in front of my TV set cheering them on. So 10 a.m., everybody. Woo!
What are you serving this morning for?
I haven't.
What do you do for 10 o'clock?
I know it's like 10 a.m. Right? It needs to be like at 5 p.m. or something. But
it's a brunch.
I know breakfast. Soccer, I guess.
There you go. Omelets. Sounds
not
good.
Not super fun. Yes.
Sorry about that.
It's like too early even for hot wings, right? It's 10 a.m. Game's over to celebrate.
There you go. And let's hope we celebrate today.
Of course we're going to celebrate.
Well, I wanted to have you on because there's a number of issues. There always are when it comes to Illinois finances. And I know you talked about, you know, really what a difference, I guess, a governor makes.
Oh, boy. Is that true or what?
Yeah. Well, don't hold back here. no, but I, as far as, you know, we get a passage of a budget that even Republicans will acknowledge is, even if they won't say it's balanced, but it's the most balanced that they've seen in their time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Republican votes for it. Capital plan gets passed, you know, something that's
$45 billion capital plan.
I mean, a jobs bill and helps. But you also caution, too, this is almost like a first step. And I mean, we still have a huge backlog of overdue bills in this state.
It's still really large. I mean, certainly not what it was, you know, a year and a half ago.
It wasn't. It's not $16 billion.
Yeah, we were looking at $16.7 billion, and we have it down to about $6.1 billion as of today. So that's it's great news, but it's we're not out of the woods yet, right? I keep saying that we can see light between the trees finally, but we're still not out of the woods.
You know the old phrase about there's light at the end of the tunnel, but it might be a freight train coming at you.
Well, no, it's not in our case, thankfully. So I'll stick with my woods analogy because, you know, we're going to get out of this. But it is going to take a few years. And that's the thing that we need to remind the public of. Just because we have a new governor and we have a new budget and things look to be moving really in a great direction, we still have a $6.1 billion backlog and I don't have enough revenue to cover that, right? So this budget, while... yeah, you could argue it's balanced. It is. I can't truly say that anything is 100% balanced if I still have a $6 billion backlog. That doesn't have to be taken into consideration when crafting the budget. That's why the budget is balanced. But, you know, this $6 billion is out there. We're on the hook for it, and we have to pay it back.
Does, I mean, I know it's premature to talk about the graduated income tax amendment, and certainly that would be something that voters would have to act on.
Yeah, the fair tax, sure.
But I mean, how much of there you're talking about $3.4 billion in
that would
revenue.
Be hugely helpful. Look, because we have about $2.5 billion of operating expenses day to day. So that $6 billion bill backlog that we've gotten it down to six, really more like, you know, four. Right now. So it's anywhere between six and seven. If you take away the $2 to $2.5 billion of daily operating expenses, it's going to take us a few years, but we're not going to get all of that $3.4 billion by any means. We'll get a percentage of that because I'm sure he's going to dedicate part of that to unfunded pension liability and other necessary expenses. But we'll be able to chip away at this bill backlog, and maybe over the next, you know, 3 to 4 years, we should be able to eliminate it. With the fair tax. If we don't have the fair tax, then we're going to be on the hook. And unfortunately, many vendors and businesses across the state of Illinois will continue to suffer waiting for payments that they deserve.
Are we in, with this backlog that we still have, though, are we in any... Are we in the calamitous situations that existed in the past with, like, certain social service agencies and those kinds of things?
Look, yes and no. I would say no... because we're not to the extent that we were when we had $16.7 billion and no legal authority to
and
make
no budget,
bills, right? Because without a budget, that was just, you know, it was like doubling down. It's like if you have your hands tied behind your back and someone's kicking you every second of the day, right? So there's no way you can even defend yourself. We were really just gasping for air. With a budget in place, we were able to get some of those dollars that were legally appropriated through the budget process, you know, out into the marketplace. So that was much more helpful. We were still in absolute triage mode. With the refinancing, if you want to think of it that way, with that $6 billion bonding deal, where we were able to cut our interest rates from 12% to 3.5%, that over the 12-year course of that loan will actually save taxpayers $4 to $6 billion. So those financial tools that we put to use are going to help to stabilize our finances, and the markets responded accordingly, moving us from a negative to a stable outlook. Right now, with the actual passage of a budget, although we still have $6.1 or $2 billion of a bill backlog, there is an additional $1.2 billion in bonding authority that I may or may not utilize, but it's good to know it's there. And I'll utilize it if it allows me to pay down bills that we're accruing 12% interest on, where we can save people money. But, you know, again, we're still triaging certain businesses that haven't been paid because I still, you know, having $6 billion in any normal universe would be like a ridiculous amount of unpaid bills. But, you know, this is Illinois. So, you know, I've been dealing,
everything's relative.
Yeah, I've been dealing in the absolute absurd where ridiculous seems manageable.
Well, and you know, you hear complaints sometimes, too, about, oh, why are we borrowing money to pay these overdue bills? And you touched on it, is there's that onerous interest rate that exists versus, you know, basically a refinancing.
Yep. So normally when people hear the word bond or borrowing, you, of course, think worst case scenario. We're borrowing money to pay bills that people might argue we should not have even incurred, but nonetheless, we incurred them. But because you're borrowing the money, you're actually paying a lot more for the service that you originally paid for. Kind of like if you put a, you buy a sweater that's on sale for $50, but you pay the minimum payments on it with your credit card, and now that sweater costs you $150, right? So, but what was different about the bonding deal that we did was that we were paying 12% interest on over $6 billion. Really, we paid almost $9 billion worth of bills that we were incurring late payment interest penalties on at 12%, because I took some of that $6 billion, leveraged it for federal matching dollars, and turned it into $9 billion. And we're able to pay down $9 billion of that $16.7 billion backlog, saving us over the course of that 12 years because of 12% going down to 3.5%, $4 to $6 billion. So this was a huge win for Illinois, not your traditional type of bonding. Normally, if I were, our bills right now, we don't owe a lot of bills that are producing late payment interest penalties, which is why I'm not in a rush to get to the market for bonding. I'll only bond out where we're actually going to see a significant cost savings for taxpayers. I'm not going to bond out just for the sake of borrowing.
We're speaking with Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, joined by Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, there's a thing called a CAFR, okay? And I know it's a very important financial document, a document that markets use. It basically is kind of a adjudication of the state's finances.
Mm-hmm.
And can't even remember what CAFR stands for.
Comprehensive Annual Financial Report.
Okay. And it sounds boring as all heck, but it's really important. And we haven't, we're way overdue on having this submitted.
Yes, and it's supposed to be due, ideally, right, in a perfect world, December 31st.
Which never happens,
never
really.
Happens. I mean, when I ran for controller, I think it had been a full 12 years since the CAFR had ever been put out relatively on time before June 30th of the next year. So you're looking at December 31st. Technically, you have until June 30th, but you're not really supposed to. It's supposed to essentially be December 31st. Never happens. Always chronically late. And I would ask, like, if this is a responsibility of the controller's office, I remember asking someone when I ran for controller, who used to work in that office, and I said, hey, why is this report chronically late? I mean, I don't get that. I don't like doing anything late. And they said, well, because even though the controller is charged with putting out this report, the report cannot be assembled until the controller receives from the auditor general a full blessing. Like, they have to audit all of the state's financials, which means every state agency has to report their financials to the auditor general. Then the auditor general actually audits all of that. And then once the auditor general compiles his findings, he submits them to the controller, who then puts the report together. So obviously, if the controller has not received the report yet from the audit, and the audit hasn't been finalized yet, and that could be for many reasons, then the controller can't actually put out the report. So we're once again in this position where it is now July, and there is no CAFR, and I can't tell you when the CAFR will come out. The auditor is still working with some state agencies that have not been able to, I can't really say too much about it other than these state agencies are working with the auditor to give the auditor the information that he needs to actually be able to finish compiling his findings and do a proper audit. But it's an area of concern. I mean, I've brought this to the attention of the press because things need to change in Illinois. It is absurd that this financial audit, just so the public understands, is for the prior fiscal year. We're already, by the time people even get this report, it's essentially not worth the paper it's printed on.
But what, I mean, what is the problem?
So this is still a hangover from the Rauner administration. Now, I can't just blame it on Rauner, because every For the last decade or so, over more than a decade, this report has been late, but never to the extent that it is right now. And, you know, my understanding is that some of the state agencies who, this is not a Pritzker thing, it's still from the prior administrations, even next year's financial report will be half of the fiscal year would have pertained to Bruce Rauner's administration. There's been some problems, which, again, I'm not privy, or I'm not at liberty to speak about. The Auditor General would do that in his report. But there's been some problems that are hangovers or consequences of some, you know, some things not going right under the Rauner administration. So that's what we're working with.
Well, I mean, is it, you know, obviously we had went without a budget, mm-hmm. those kinds of things. But also, you know, is there concern about any kind of attempts at financial manipulation to try to maybe make things at one point during that tenure a little bit rosier financially?
No, I don't think that that's it. I just think that there was,
or it's,
you
just,
know, there's
just all
a ton
messed
of,
up.
Yeah, I don't think it's any kind of like malicious thing. I'm not going to throw that.
No, I will.
But I think it's just, you know, shoddy record keeping potentially. I really don't know. But I mean, this is essentially what I've been led to maybe kind of believe. And, you know, we saw, I mean, this is public record, that there have been a lot of failures with system implementations and stuff, right? That could potentially lead to, you know, data collection problems. So, again, the CAFR is all about analyzing the state's financial data, and it is really unprecedented that we don't have that data yet to fully analyzed. So we're waiting on the Auditor General to give us the all clear to compile the report. But my office has been ready since December to get it done. And, you know, I'm very just kind of disgusted with this whole process. And we need to do something to change it moving forward.
I also want to ask you about a ruling in the Cook County Circuit Court over the issue of legislative salary.
Wow, bam, bam. Like, I just mentioned the word disgust, and you bring that up. It's perfect.
I know you're not happy about this.
No. So
two former members of the General Assembly filed suit claiming that the taking of furloughs, which were part of action by the General Assembly, that enacting those furloughs, as mm-hmm. well as not accepting cost of living increases during several years.
Yeah, I mean, we had really tough times in Illinois, and everybody had to share the pain, right? And as elected officials, I thought it was the right thing to do. And I served during part of that time to not take those pay increases while people across our state were struggling. This lawsuit is disgusting on so many levels because, you know, Senator Nolan, who's the lead plaintiff in this case, who brought this case, we challenged it on the grounds that he was no longer even in the legislature and therefore had no standing. And because we won on that, he enlisted another state legislator to jump on board who was in the state Senate at the time, who could claim that he had legal standing to bring forth this lawsuit. And essentially, they claim that those very raises that they themselves voted for, right? I mean, that they voted to not take.
Correct.
And Senator Nolan even went so far as being on the record pontificating as to why it was the right thing to do to deny these pay increases to themselves. Once he was no longer in the legislature, turns around and sues for that money. I mean, it's so sick on so many levels. It's exactly why people do not trust us. And it's nothing more than a nasty money grab by, you know, these politicians that frankly don't deserve to have ever served, as far as I'm concerned.
So this was a ruling in the Cook County court that...
Yeah, they ruled in favor of, you know, Senator Nolan's shameless lawsuit. So, like, it never ceases to surprise me the levels that people will go to, but we're going to fight it. And I just think it's the right thing to do on principle.
Well, you know, I did read the ruling and I wasn't clear, but it didn't look like you were directed to pay these.
Yeah, not yet. There's going to be another follow-up on August 6th where the judge may decide to tell us that we have to pay it. We're still waiting to see what happens in court on August 6th. But, you know, it's a complex lawsuit.
It's a constitutional question.
It is. It's a constitutional question. And, you know, there's always two sides to an argument, right? They're claiming that it's unconstitutional. There are lots of people who might agree that it's unconstitutional. A judge clearly said that it was unconstitutional. Yet I would still argue that if that's the case, that changing a legislator's salary, pro or against, midterm, with these cost of living allowances, if that's unconstitutional, then implementing a cost of living allowance as something that legislators could get, which they did in 1990, should therefore be unconstitutional in and of itself. So, but the judge is not ruling on that behalf. So, you know, we'll see what happens August 6th. I just think that I've seen a lot of lawsuits, right? I mean, I get sued all the time as a state controller.
Well, because you're in charge of the payouts.
Yeah, it's not anything right. I've done personally. It's just that the office of controller gets sued all the time by everyone because people want their money. And I can't argue, really. I mean, on a moral perspective, it's hard to ever say, well, that person doesn't deserve to get paid because we owe them money. But in this case, these guys do not deserve a penny. I mean, I feel so sad for taxpayers that they ever actually served, because they were just serving themselves, and they continue to just serve themselves. And then Senator Nolan went on to become a judge. It just, like, my head wants to explode right now, right? So this is just, it's shameless. It really is. And it makes me very sad that we're in a situation where we would even have this happening. I mean, it's exactly why people don't trust us. And, you know, just please, if you don't like what you're hearing right now, just, you know, burn up this guy's phone, you know, send him emails, post about this on Facebook. I don't think it's going to matter because the guy clearly has no shame, but, you know, it's going to make me feel a little bit better.
Okay, I'm glad we know where you stand on that. Actually, since he's a judge, doesn't he have a conflict of interest by bringing a lawsuit?
It's just the guy has no shame.
Just a question there.
I don't think he understands what that concept is, you know? Yeah. It's that's why he enlisted someone else to help do his dirty work.
That is Illinois State Comptroller Susana Mendoza.
You got me all fired up now.
Well, just get this is the pregame warm up for 10 o'clock, all right? Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. Everybody have a great weekend, and please cheer on the women's soccer team. Go USA.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. A couple of national news notes. Dave's been reporting this as well, but a new Washington Post ABC News poll about President Trump showing 44% of Americans approve of Trump's overall job performance. That's up slightly by 5 percentage points from April and 2 points better than his peak early in his presidency. Still, despite that 44% approval rate, 53% disapprove, and that's keeping him at majority disapprove continuously for his first 2.5 years in office. As the ABC News pollster notes, that's a record for any president in modern polling to continue to poll negatively. Couple of interesting findings in this poll by Gary Langer and Langer Research. Congress should initiate impeachment proceedings against Trump. The number remains unchanged. 37% say yes. Opposition opposed 59%. 61% of Democrats favor impeachment, but just 37% of independents and 7% of Republicans agree. So that's the ABC News Washington Post poll. Also, overnight, I thought it was interesting, story in the Daily Mail in the UK that the British ambassador to Washington has described Donald Trump as, quote, inept, insecure, and incompetent in a series of memos to Downing Street. Sir Kim Derrick, who is one of Britain's top diplomats, used cables, secret cables, and briefing notes, warning London that the White House was uniquely dysfunctional and that the president's career could end in disgrace. I actually met Sir Kim, the ambassador, during a Midwest trip, stopped in Chicago, and wanted to get a off-the-record sampling of national and state politics, and shared a cheeseburger at the Billy Goat, which I thought was only appropriate to take the ambassador from the UK to the Billy Goat and get a little taste of Chicago. Joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is my good friend Ray Long, longtime colleague, longtime friend, who is now part of the investigative team at the Chicago Tribune. Used to be State House correspondent and manned the wavelengths of Springfield down there. And Ray has been the author of a number of very interesting stories, but most recently has been one that involves depositions over a lawsuit that raises issues about Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan's legislative reelection. So, Ray, I want you to take us back to just kind of set the stage of, you know, what are we looking at here that precipitated this lawsuit?
Okay, Rick, thanks again for having me on.
And take your time, because this is a lengthy...
yeah, sit back and take a drag That's out right. of your coffee right now. So back in 2016, Michael Madigan was running in the primary, and that was in March. And so...
March
Democratic primary, and Jason Gonzalez had filed also, and he is a young Hispanic, had only been in the district for a while. Madigan clearly was an overwhelmingly favorite, and so
yeah, he was a no-name for the most part.
And so a couple other names popped up on the ballot, and those were both Hispanic-sounding names, Joe Barboza and Graziella Rodriguez. And we have seen depositions. Jason Gonzalez thought that these two were sham candidates. He made that clear during the election. And after he lost, he filed a suit saying that they were sham candidates and this is a civil rights voting violation and that they should not have been allowed to be on the ballot. And so the question is, did they dilute his ability to collect some votes? Did they confuse voters, in other words? And so he's brought that to a federal court and sued Madigan and his operations, and now we're hearing from some of the insiders who are telling some of the stories about how this came about. And so what we got recently were a couple of depositions. One was from a guy named Joe Nasella, and he has knocked around in various different jobs in the city and Cicero, etc. And he has also worked on various campaigns. He had gone in and worked a little bit inside the 13th Ward office.
Which is the Speaker's home office.
Right. The Speaker has been committeeman there for decades, of course. And so one day, while he was in there, Kevin Quinn, one of Madigan's top aides at the time, went to Nasella, according to Nasella's deposition, and said, can you go out and collect some signatures, petitions, nominating petitions to get on the ballot? You have to have a certain number of signatures. And he was asked to do it not on behalf of the Speaker, but on behalf of Graziella Rodriguez. And so he was kind of puzzled about this. According to the deposition, he asked, why would you want to have me go out and collect signatures against the Speaker? In other words, for somebody running against the Speaker. And he said he was met with a poker face and that... he was questioned during the deposition, well, what do you mean by that? A blank stare was what he said. So, in other words, Kevin Quinn, the person who asked him to go out there, according to his deposition, wanted him to go collect signatures to have somebody run against the Speaker and in the March primary. So the idea there was, if this was happening, and what Gonzalez alleges is that these two candidates, Barboza and Rodriguez were put up as phony candidates to try to confuse voters, to bleed off some of the votes that Gonzalez got. Now, the speaker ultimately won with almost two-thirds of the vote, and most likely, overwhelmingly, would have won anyway.
Well, let's leave that right there, and we'll use that as a tease, because there's more to this story.
Yes.
That's we'll be talking about in just a moment. You're listening to The Sunday Spin with Rick Pearson and my good friend Ray Long from the Tribune. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by my good friend and colleague at the Tribune, Ray Long. We're talking about some depositions that came out of a lawsuit, a federal voting rights lawsuit that was filed by a one-time opponent of Illinois Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan in a Democratic primary involving Madigan's reelection. And I want to ask you, Ray, so, you know, here you have these depositions. You've got a, you know, a top political operative at the time to the speaker telling, you know, basically a ward hack, to be honest, to go get signatures. And of course, yeah, you go get signatures for the boss. No, not the ward boss, for the guy, for a guy running against him or a woman running against him. That's what we want you to do. That's kind of what we have here. The fundamental question I have, and I really, it's a question as reporters, our job is supposed to get answers to questions. But this isn't a question that I know you can answer, but it's like, this is Mike Madigan. Why would this need to happen for Speaker Madigan's reelection, which is tantamount winning the primary? You've won reelection. He won reelection, and he won it big.
Yeah, he did. And as a matter of fact, we got a hold of one of his deposition earlier and reported about it, and he said he was concerned that this was a Republican invasion of the primary, that Gonzalez was backed by Republican money, Rauner money, and other critics of Madigan, and so therefore Madigan said that he was worried about this election. Now, he did not say and has denied having any association with these so-called put-up candidates, but that is the question. The question is, why was this guy worried even? Now, one reason could be the ward has changed a lot.
Certainly, and as we have seen in the Southwest side, that you are seeing a lot more of a Latino influence in
right.
those wards.
Right. It's up to, and I think the map was drawn so it would be about 60% Hispanic, and now has probably even increased since then. And so that has been one issue. And now you have a ballot where there's four people on it, and you have three Hispanic names, and then you've got people who are not totally involved and knowledgeable about the candidates. They may want to vote against Madigan, but they're not quite sure which one they're supposed to vote for. That was the alleged game plan that confused. That is alleged in the lawsuit.
But Gonzalez's lawsuit alleges this was disenfranchisement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But and at the same time, though, even if he were to have gotten those stray votes,
right,
he still wouldn't have won.
Right. And the side that Gonzalez is taking, and his lawyer, by the way, is a Republican, Tony Pareca,
right,
a former county board member, and they have argued that, hey, if there hadn't been this confusion, they would have been able to get more votes, and it would have been able to consolidate their effort better.
Because it would have been a, quote, one-on-one race.
Correct.
And that
Correct.
Changes the dynamics.
Exactly.
That's their argument, is that would have changed the dynamics of the race.
Right.
Instead of trying to differentiate yourself from these other
exactly.
Hispanic surname
exactly.
candidates.
Yeah, but, you know, one other part of this was another deposition that we were talking about off air, and that was a guy named Michael Kuba went around and was going with a guy named Eugene Pagoas, who was a 13th ward committeeman. Again, the 13th ward being the speaker's ward. And so the allegation that Gonzalez is making is that Kuba was just a guy who happened to go along, and they used him, the 13th Ward folks used him to sign as the official circulator. So when the 13th Ward precinct committeeman who went along and said that he had Kuba, the no name, unaffiliated guy with the 13th Ward, signed, they were able to kind of obscure the connection there between the 13th Ward. So they have this kind of alleged masking that's going along. But again, this is an effort here to try to recuperate damages in a federal civil lawsuit. This is not a criminal case. Another interesting point about this is Kevin Quinn, the fellow that
I was just going to mention that. If you tell us about
Kevin Quinn, the fellow that we mentioned in the other case, who allegedly told this first fella Nasella to go out and get signatures, has had his own issues, and has since this time happened got tossed out of the government and political operations of Mike Madigan because he allegedly sexually harassed a campaign worker. And so he made headlines himself, and recently his home was raided by the FBI.
And we don't know why.
We don't know why. We were told by a source that the FBI had shown interest in computers, but that's not an unusual
thing. That's the traditional picture we see, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
But what's on those computers is the question we all have.
And, again, he was, very much a high-ranking part of the Madigan operation.
Well, absolutely. Brother of Alderman Marty Quinn. And so he is like the third in line in the 13th Ward there, if you will. There's no real organizational chart other than Mike Madigan at the top, Marty Quinn next, and then Kevin Quinn, who was one of these guys who carried out a lot of the assignments.
So where do we stand as far as this lawsuit?
The lawsuit is being debated now as to whether it will even go to trial. So
so we're still in the pleading stage, basically.
As a matter of fact, the Madigan folks have pleaded and said this all should be thrown out, Gonzalez response is due in the coming days, and judge is expected to rule within coming weeks or coming months.
So, obviously it's a lawsuit or pending litigation. There's never a time frame on this kind of thing.
Right.
But we're at the stage now to see, does it progress?
Right. And it's really interesting to know, because what we're seeing here more than anything, even if this doesn't go to trial, we are seeing the curtain pulled back, at least allegedly, on what is going on behind the scenes. It's a better glimpse than we've ever seen before.
That's Ray Long, my Tribune colleague, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune, on some pretty fascinating details out of depositions involving a lawsuit over Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan's reelection. Ray, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Great to be here, bud.